Get off my world.
Get off my world.
Get off my world.
To me. Get off my world. It's pain.
Get off my world.
Get off my world. If you don't, you're gonna get it.
Get off my world.
Get off my world. Or I'm gonna bury you in it.
Hi, I'm Joshua.
I'm Kelvin.
And I'm Pat.
And this is Get Off My World, a Doctor Who podcast. We're three middle-aged men who love the classic Doctor Who series and do our best to indulge the new series, too. We'll take you through five rounds rapid and get to the bottom of what's great and not so great about our favorite show. And today, we're really excited because we are here at Console Room, the Twin Cities premier Doctor Who convention.
Yay!
Yay! Celebration in silver.
Yes.
Because
their badges
are
so humongous.
Cyberman's 50th anniversary. Yep. Thus, the celebration in silver.
There are special guests here. Fraser Hines.
Yeah.
Annika Wills. Wendy Padbury. And Dominic Glynn. I've not met any of them. And they're not here in this room to record with us. But, just as good, we have two other special guests with us tonight. Christopher Jones.
Hello.
And Jimmy LeDuc.
Hello.
Gentlemen, thank you for joining us.
I apologize for not being Fraser Hines or any of the other people you mentioned earlier, but I'm delighted to be here.
Few of us can be.
Well, one, really. And he's in this building. Let's go find him.
The least you could have done is to dress up like Polly or something.
They wouldn't know. Just pretend I dress like Polly.
But big eyes you have, Christopher Jones.
Thank you.
And long legs.
Why, thank you. I'll be climbing up a ladder later for your enjoyment.
God. Well, as you know, as our longtime listeners... As our listeners know, we like to start this podcast with something we call temporal grace. This is something that we just kind of love about the universe of Doctor Who. This is because we sometimes get a little bit grumpy about other things, and so we like to start things on a more positive note.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, Josh, Kelvin, guys, we can all agree that we're happy to be here at this convention.
Oh, right? Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Console Room is our happy thing, and so... We'd like to talk a little with our guests here for Temporal Grace, because we're really happy you're here, too. Jimmy, I think I met you, like, a year ago here.
Really?
I think it was official.
That's where I met you, in Console Room last year.
Tell us a little about your background with Doctor Who fandom.
I can remember specifically being a child in Memphis, Tennessee, of all places, and turning on WKNO-TV, which was public television in Memphis, and... The first episode I saw was, basically the whole series leading Pertwee and into Tom Baker. And so, really, I always say Tom Baker was a little bit of Pertwee, but really it was Tom Baker that was my doctor that I discovered Doctor Who with. So, and I just fell in love with him. I thought he was hilarious. I remember every Saturday it aired at 4:00, I specifically remember, and I would run to the TV and make sure that I saw it. My obsession, we shall say, grew over many years and still has grown as time has gone on.
Because one thing I remember talking with you about last year was Big Finish audios. Because
yes.
I rarely bump into somebody who is as avid a listener as I am. And I was like, this guy's listened to Tom.
When Tom started doing them, might have been one of the happiest days of my life. Yes, because it's been fun to like hear him and especially knowing now that he and Louise Davidson have a very different relationship now than they did at the time, and they're now pals, but at the time, of course, we know that was not necessarily the case. Yeah. But I've been enjoying revisiting that, and then also discovering so many new things, and especially with some of the Lost episodes. It's with Frasier, too, it's amazing to me, because when he does The Second Doctor, it's amazing.
It
I lose myself. And
we'll be talking about one of those later on.
Yeah. I mean, you lose yourself. It is like trotting his back. So yeah, so I do. I'm a huge Big Finish person.
Awesome.
Listen to a lot in my car.
What about you, Chris Jones?
Oh, finally I get to talk. my first exposure to Doctor Who, I don't remember why I picked it up not having seen the show yet. I actually laid my hands on a couple of Doctor Who comic books before I ever actually got to see the TV show. Marvel Comics, I think, in Marvel Premiere had reprinted
Two issues with the fourth
Doctor. Yeah, a few issues of the Marvel UK's Doctor Who comic. So it was beautiful Dave Gibbons artwork, and that was my first exposure. And I knew that I liked it, but certainly seeing the Doctor, and especially Tom Baker's fourth Doctor on the printed page, you don't get the full effect of that performance and that characterization. So, you know, it gave me a certain grounding as a starting point, and I had read the information about like how long the show had been around, and there were all these previous Doctors, and I was just sort of fascinated by it having all that history to it. And then the first chance I actually had to see an episode was when our local PBS station started showing individual 25-minute episodes weekday afternoons, and I somehow, they started with the beginning of Tom Baker's run, I somehow perfectly missed all four episodes of Robot. So my very first Doctor Who I ever saw was episode one of Ark in Space, which is not a bad episode to start on.
No,
I mean, not is it a great episode, but you think about how episode one of that is structured, and what a great slow burn introduction to Doctor Who and how that works. When the TV science fiction you've had previously is dominated by something like Star Trek, and this police box lands, and instead of a survey team coming out and waving tricorders around, you have Tom Baker playing with a yo-yo and declaring that they're in an artificial gravity environment. I'm like, this is great! and, you know, the fact that they spend that whole first episode pretty much the Doctor and two companions on their own in an abandoned space station just dealing with automated security systems, that was amazing. I'd never seen anything like that. So, yeah, I mean, I'm definitely one of the American fans that Tom Baker was my Doctor, in that I saw all of his episodes through, I think, at least two or three times before I ever got to see anything of another Doctor. Although, the way my brain works, people ask me about a favorite Doctor now, and I honestly can't pick one. Yeah. I do not have favorites. It's all, I like different Doctors for different things, and it depends on my mood and all of that. I'm a big fan of the new series. I've not heard every single one of the Big Finish audios, but I've consumed a ton of those.
Getting back to comic books.
Yes.
You have some familiarity with that medium.
Yeah, I am a professional comic book artist, and as I said earlier at opening ceremony here at Console Room, I have been fortunate enough to appear at a number of these Doctor Who conventions now, and I've always felt a little bit like a fraud because they've been happy to have me because of my comic book art credentials, and I've done a number of prints and fan art featuring Doctor Who, but I have never had any official Doctor Who credits until finally this week they just announced the Third Doctor miniseries I will be drawing, a 5-issue miniseries written by Paul Cornell. And
who?
he is a struggling up-and-comer British author.
Not interested.
Yeah, well, I mean, God, he's written like TV and books and comics. Like, pick a medium, dude. You'll have more success if you focus.
Yeah.
That's why I always tell him when I talk to him. the script for the first issue is as marvelous as you would suspect.
Tell us everything about it right now.
Yes. Well, all right, on page one, when I first found out I was going to be drawing a Third Doctor story, your brain immediately puts together this checklist of, I hope it includes, so I get to draw, blank, 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 blank. And it ticked all the boxes. It is a love letter to the era. It's marvelous. I believe our first issue comes out in September, and I'm so looking forward to everyone seeing it then.
We'll have you back when it comes out.
Oh, thanks.
So that you can sit silently while we review it.
Excellent. Well, we liked the story, but the artwork is terrible.
Not nearly enough shots of Joe's panties.
I'll do what I can. Joe's not even in this scene. Why are her panties there? Meanwhile, at unit headquarters, Joe's panties. No.
Hi, next up we have Special Topics Dalek, and it's my understanding that our guest Jimmy has a special topic of a Dalek-like nature, possibly, for us, or is it a special topic Cyberman?
It is not, actually. Okay. It is because of the fact that I was thinking, we're at Console Room, and we have three guests that are all companions. My special topic is companion related. If one of us, perchance, was picked as the next Doctor, we have to go back and pick one to two of those companions to take with us and why, that have already been companions or are currently companions at this point.
Wow. So who would we choose to take on our own adventures through time and space? Yes.
Are we extending this to non-TV show media?
Sure.
Okay.
I'm game.
That makes it even harder.
Yeah. I'm just opening it up.
Yeah.
So I'm going to say Chameleon.
Okay.
All right.
Justify it.
And Leela. Mm-hmm. Because this could be like a whole Mission Impossible kind of team.
Right? Yeah.
Because you've got Chameleon who can... you know, disguise himself as anything, and he can, okay, we'll go in there and get the secret codes. Right. And then when you need, like, a big bruiser, I guess I don't want to call Louise Jameson a big bruiser. That's not actually where I was going with that. If you need a person of violence to do a thing, she's always very competent at kicking ass.
I can't give you a great articulation for why, but for some reason the first name that comes to my mind is Aramem.
And from the audios.
Yeah.
She's from ancient Egypt.
Yeah.
She's an Egyptian princess.
Oh.
I think like a weird, because of the weird combination of, she's very competent, very self-assured, but you would still have that Eliza Doolittle Henry Higgins kind of thing where I would have to explain a lot of things to her.
And we know you love mansplaining.
Yes.
So you're matching the companion to your personality.
I guess. Yeah. I guess.
Yeah. You want just her? Or do you want like Beef the Meep or somebody with you?
No. possibly Jamie. Just because, like, if we didn't have anything particular to do, you know, it's like, hey, want to go check out this pub? Well, and Jamie would probably be the most like, yes!
Well, you can mansplain to him, too.
Yeah. All day long.
That is true.
So mansplaining and a drinking buddy are really the two elements you're most concerned with.
Now that this is out in the open, I do realize that there's some psychological issues I will need to work through that I had not really consciously been aware of.
Okay.
But
it's a process, Colin.
It is. Yeah.
I would love to travel with Ace.
Mm. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And then I would go back and pick up Victoria just so Ace could just kick her ass. Just totally... Totally grow that girl up. They could go fight like for 10 years in the Dalek Wars, like in the NAs, and Victoria could go back this hardened Dalek killer with Ace, and maybe she'd lose an eye, so she'd have an eye patch, a terrible scar across her pretty face,
and dressed in raggedy versions of her beautiful Victorian
dresses in shreds.
I can't tell if this is a choice driven by the fact that there's something you like about Victoria or a deep-seated hatred of Victoria.
It's the potential I see in Victoria.
Have you been reading a lot of 2000 AD comics?
It does occur to me if your two companions were Chameleon and Frobisher, you would never be sure
who is who,
really. But no, if I was having to pick two, I think I'd be sorely tempted to go with Romana. Probably the second Romana, if only because then somebody would know how to fly the TARDIS. Right. I wouldn't trust myself, not for a second. You mentioned Ace. Ace has always been a favorite, both in terms of liking her personality, and again, another one of these very competent, able to take care of herself, strong personality. And, you know, I don't know there's anything more to it than that, it occurs to me. It's like I picked just two of my favorite companions in answer to that question, and I think that's partly why they're among my favorite companions. I like companions that are strong characters in their own right and competent, rather than just someone there to be the foil for the Doctor answering their questions and getting into trouble and all that. So, I mean, those would be my two.
It was hard for me, and I came up with this topic going, there's so many companions and different reasons, but I would go with Sarah Jane just because she was the person that I love, and I've always adored her, and that was heartbreaking when Elizabeth passed away for me. I always loved Sarah Jane because she, you know, and I loved watching her progression, and then when she returned to the new series too, and then her own series as well. But I don't know, there was always something so, I felt like still she was able to stand on her own two feet and was not just, you know, a simpering, you know, what's going on constantly. I felt like she was willing to take her own risks, and I always just loved that character. And I would go with Jamie just because similar things. I think he's, first of all, he's amusing. Mm-hmm. And he will be headstrong, sometimes not in the best way or make the best decision, but he'll at least take a, you know, go for something, whatever that is. Sometimes it's definitely the wrong choice. And also my love of all things Scottish, which, you know, and knowing things, you know, which led to my love of Outlander. And then finding out that Diana, who wrote the Outlander series, not a guy with them, totally took that idea. Jamie was sort of one of her inspirations for her Jamie in that series. So, yeah. So I think I would just, you know, and I also think the contrast of putting Sarah Jane and Jamie together would be very interesting to see.
Get along very well.
Yes, I think so. So
you would probably occasionally feel like the outsider there.
Yes, I think so. I think
they would be having too much fun.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
And now it's time for round three, in which, because we're at console room, we decided to listen to a Big Finish audio that stars Fraser Hines and Wendy Padbury. So we chose Lords of the Red Planet, a six-part... six-part Big Finish audio written by John Dorney, adapted from original story ideas by Brian Hales. Now, as I understand it, in season six, Brian Hales wrote a number of treatments for possible Doctor Who stories. One of them was Lords of the Red Planet, which he wrote twice. He apparently wrote two separate treatments. What he also wrote was The Seeds of Death, which was the story that got filmed in place of this one. They're both Ice Warrior stories. Lords of the Red Planet is sort of an origin of the Ice Warrior story. So these scripts, or rather, I guess, treatments existed. And when Big Finish decided to do it as part of their Lost Stories series, John Dorney adapted it from both of the original Lords of the Red Planet treatments. So, so it stars Fraser Hines playing both Jamie and the Second Doctor.
Mm-hmm. Right.
It stars Wendy Padbury as Zoe, and it has a number of other interesting people in it too, including Michael Troughton, son of Patrick, playing Quendril, and Charlie Hayes, Wendy Padbury's daughter, playing Veltrina.
Oh, and then, I didn't realize that was Wendy Padbury's daughter.
I didn't until I listened to the behind-the-scenes stuff.
Whoa.
Yeah. So it's a real family affair. And, of course, Nicholas Briggs plays everyone else.
Yes. Right, yes, he does.
Yeah, one of the interesting things about this is that it splits the difference between an audio book with narration and an actual full cast audio. Part of that, I think, was charming in that it made it feel authentic. It felt like one of those soundtracks from a Lost Patrick Troughton episode.
Well, and if the idea is to give you a glimpse of a story that might have been a television story, it means you can leave the story tailored to what would have worked for television as opposed to all the things that you have to do in writing for audio to make sure that it's well-suited for that medium.
Yes.
Right.
So you'd get all the linking narrative and stuff that is a little awkward for audio, but you're essentially adapting a non-existing television story for audio.
And occasionally, like the Target novelizations, it describes the special effects and the aliens in a way that you know they could never have realized.
Oh, right.
But again, it feels very Doctor Who-y in that we're so used to the Target novelizations,
yes,
like blowing up the descriptions of the TV show. Because if you've ever had the experience of reading a Target novelization when you're young and then watching the TV show, it was always like, oh.
This is how they did that.
Okay.
And you're always able to imagine the most idealized version of the alien makeup and the monster costumes and the spaceships and explosions and all of that, as opposed to the...
Particularly, there's a big Ice Warrior battle in the mines toward the end of the Ice Lord fights off all these Ice Warriors, and it is described in a very epic quality. It's very fun to listen to, but you know it would just be really slow if they televised it.
Yeah.
Guys in cumbersome outfits just sort of patting each other on the back and then falling over.
Well, it is true, because I kept contrasting what I knew they looked like as opposed to what it sounded like in the audio, which was interesting to kind of have that. And then also my idea of what did that mean, the super slave, so to speak, looked like.
Yeah, and famously, those costumes were almost completely immobile.
Yeah, right.
They would just fall over.
So I kept thinking, they're like, would the super slave have just had to stand there the whole time, the show? Like, would he have really been able to do any of that action?
I seem to remember that there was some talk in the behind-the-scenes commentary on this release, that some speculation that perhaps why this story was not chosen as opposed to the story that they did make in its place was that it seemed a little more ambitious in its scope and might have been harder to produce. Like,
can you write a story with bubble bath? Because we can do bubble bath.
But, you know, part of what I actually really liked about this one is, given that, you know, the Ice Warriors are a Doctor Who monster that I think a lot of us have a lot of affection for, one of the limitations is that they are so kind of generic and don't have a lot of individual personality. And this was a story that actually seemed to invest a lot of character drama into an Ice Warriors narrative, which I liked a lot. And I'm curious how effectively they could have accomplished that part of it at the time, given the limitations of the makeup and the costumes and all of that, regardless of the more epic elements of the overall plot line.
Well, you know, and I think you're right to the degree that the secondary characters are kind of interesting and engaging. But what's interesting is that they're not Ice Warriors.
Yeah,
they're the Gandorans. Right. So the plot of it is that the Gandorans are on Mars and their race is dying out, and so in various sort of pseudoscientific ways, they're trying to create a race to somehow carry on their
civilization. Very much like Genesis of the Daleks.
Really. Yes,
it is an accelerated evolution of.
But what's strange is that, of course, they're making the Ice Warrior race out of not them. They're kidnapping Saurians from the surface of Mars and evolving them more quickly, and then doing like a brain, a vague brain patterning on them. So there is no real genetic continuity, as far as I can tell, between the Gandorans and the Ice Warriors. But anyway, that's maybe something I'll put a pin in and we can talk about a little bit later. But the Ice Warriors, as we see them established here, are just the same generic Ice Warriors that we always see on television, with the exception of Aslor,
who is
also sort of a problematic character because he's a Frankenstein character. He's a Frankenstein's monster character.
The whole opening scene is a complete Frankenstein homage. So you see, I mean, to me, that whole opening beginning was totally that. Exactly. Mm-hmm. I mean, and it felt it. And I mean, it was like, I literally felt like, well, we're watching Frankenstein right now.
Well, I mean, that's part of what I was curious about is, had this been realized as a television episode, I mean, does he become sort of a prototype of what would be an Ice Lord then? Or?
They do call him an Ice Lord.
Yeah.
I was a bit disappointed in this as an Ice Warrior origin story, partly because it's not really... Well, let me back up. It's the Ice Warriors were so thinly established on the original TV series that you only got these hints. There are Ice Warriors and there are Ice Lords. And there's a sort of vaguely samurai feel about the Ice Lords. They have some talk of honor and such like that. And so there's a hint of a culture behind it. You don't know what the culture is. You know that they're not 100% evil because you see them in the Peladon stories and they're essentially a normal race. They're not a monstrously murderous race like the Cybermen are. And so there's this sense that there's a culture behind them. And so I was disappointed to learn, at least as this audio establishes it, that it's not a culture. They're created. Ice Lord is created to have lordly qualities about him. He's going to be a leader. He's going to have these, which we don't necessarily see any of that in exhibit in Lords of the Red Planet, because Aslor doesn't really have any personality to speak of. But I was like, oh, so it's just... There isn't a culture. It's just formed a Frankensteinian way.
That was the thing I had a hard time getting past. Is like, I just couldn't figure out why the Ice Warriors needed an origin story in the first place. The germ of the idea of this thing was way back in the 60s. So years later, we've seen Genesis of the Daleks and the audio story Spare Parts and all these other kind of origin stories. And it seems like a weird... You know, in retrospect, it seems like a weird rehashing of that and like a weird diminishing of the Ice Warriors, because I really kind of like the Ice Warriors. Kind of what you were suggesting at. They're one of the few neutral-ish aliens in Doctor Who. Mm-hmm. You know, they're kind of like next-generation Klingons.
Yeah.
In a way, you know, they're admirable and they're allies, but they can still be adversaries.
However, they do the reset button at the end. Destroy all these Ice Warriors and say this is just sort of an early blip, a glimpse into what could be. They reset it. They end on a little turtle creature. You will become the Ice Warriors, so all this sort of history that is hinted at later is still
Which is a weirdly non-committal ending, given that, like, too. Here's an origin for the Ice Warriors. Well, maybe.
My guess is the original outline had the Ice Warrior survive, and this was the origin. And they, in rewriting it, they want this to stand as the lost story, but also connect up with the Ice Warriors as we now know them.
Seems like a reasonable guess.
Yeah, the little turtle thing, just sort of watching the TARDIS vanish and eating leaves, was kind of cute.
It was honestly my favorite part. Someone did chomping sound effects.
Yeah. Well, although as they're describing it, and I forget what the turn of phrase was, they're sort of like, you know, it looks to the sky and wonders, well, but like, yeah, on TV that would be like, and here's footage of a turtle.
Yeah. Right. Yes. Somebody's pet turtle.
I don't think it would have been nearly as poetic without somehow that narrative flourish.
Yeah. It's a little Jurassic Parky. It is a little. That's what it made me think of immediately. It was like the whole DNA is getting, you know, I don't know why, for some reason that popped into my mind. The dinosaurs are off the island. But I just kept thinking, you know, like, well, we're going to blow up the island, but did we? You know, I kept thinking that, and it was that kind of idea of.
What is interesting, too, that what Zardur is, she has an emotional, well, in as much as she can have an emotional attachment to anything, she has an emotional attachment to the Ice Warriors, even though there's no genetic continuity between her and them, but she identifies with them more than she does her original race. Mm-hmm. And that's a mark of her insanity and her megalomania, but it read more real to me than the scientists trying to create a new race out of the Saurians somehow, because in her insanity, she's like, oh, I'm not a part of the original Gandoran race.
Well, the plot element is the Ice Warriors were created to do work that the Gandorians couldn't do. Exactly. So they're sort of created as a slave race because they've destroyed the surface of the planet, and to try to explain the Ice Warriors' ability to withstand cold temperatures. So I think from the scientist's point of view, he thought they were creating a slave race, and she thinks they're creating a warrior race.
I was
going
to say, like, she wants these warriors. They're her stormtroopers. So yeah. I kept thinking.
I liked that question of, well, who are they going to fight?
Right, I know that was it.
No one else around.
Who are we going to, yeah. It was.
Oh, wait, Earth.
Right.
which brings in the whole question of just how far in the past is this?
Yeah, what's on Earth right now? Are there dinosaurs on Earth?
Yeah, I was.
Are there Silurians on Earth?
It's kind of suggestive.
Let's do that audio.
The Ice Warriors.
Silurians. Oh my God!
If you're listening, Big Finish. Oh my goodness, that would be fun.
One thing I may have just spaced out when this was on the story. Did they ever really explain what the hell life drink was?
No.
It's some kind of mineral slime.
It's Gandoran energy drink.
It's Ketracel White.
Yeah.
It's a liquid plot device, is what it is.
It's what they had instead of Red Bull.
It's MacGuffin juice.
Yes.
It's their Soylent Green, I think is what it is. I don't know. Yeah.
It is made out of, like, dead people?
No.
Okay.
I'm just joking, but I don't know, because I don't think they ever, that I remember.
Yeah, like it was, like they actually had to mine it?
The life juice is just supposed to be these nutrients that are no longer on the planet that they have to somehow create chemically.
Someday we're going to have to do a special topics Dalek on just mining in Doctor Who.
There's a lot.
How many Doctor Who stories have mines in them?
It's a topic to be mined, for sure.
Well, that was the other thing. Speaking of things that it was interesting to pick, when the explosion happened, and spoiler alert, and the city, and when everything's exploding and the city's exploding, and I was thinking, that was another one of those moments, is I was like, well, here we're hearing all these sound effects, it's like these scenes that are going on, but I kept thinking, what would this have looked like?
And it was violent for Doctor Who.
It was.
We're just walking through,
horrible.
Murdering,
and people were just and then
survives.
They were like, "You're left. I'm going to kill you right here."
I am sure they would have used that great volcano stock footage that they recycle a lot.
Yes, but it was. But I agree. It was it's a pretty brutal section.
Oh yeah, Zardur kills Veltrina right in front of her dad,
which is,
and then the entire city, people are crushed to death.
Yeah, and then, like you said, it's just like, you survived, you're dead, and now I'm just going to shoot you, and we're done, you know.
Well, let's go to the TARDIS, bye.
Right, exactly.
Dum-de-dum-de-dum.
I also just want to piggyback on Jimmy's earlier comments on Fraser Hines doing Patrick Troughton's voice, and it was pretty fun to listen to, that sort of cadence.
You can hear the Scots coming through every now and then.
Yes. Yeah.
But still,
that rhythm is just sort of so right on.
It was not so flawless that you know, you wouldn't have known if somehow you didn't know that we lost Patrick Troughton quite a while ago. But it was certainly not only very good, but there's something very satisfying that makes it feel okay that it was someone part of the original production.
It's very
offering the voice.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think that's it. It's like, yeah, there are moments where you know it's Fraser Hines, but I think there is something about it. And I think, too, you brought up, it's the rhythm, too, and the cadence that he uses. Mm-hmm. Even when he slips into, because you hear the Scots, of course, come out. But I love when he's just like, it's just exactly how, I just sort of, many times where I'm like, that's I can imagine him saying those lines.
Yeah, I mean, I think some of those hesitating mannerisms feel a little more affected with Fraser doing them. But I mean, to be fair, he is doing an impression of somebody else rather than Troughton just giving a performance still as himself.
Well, before we leave this topic, I do want to point out that the doctor in this story names the Ice Warriors.
Yes.
Is this some kind of bootstrap paradox? Yeah. Where did that name come from if he first heard it?
You're right. It is a bootstrap.
Mm. Oh, dear.
I know, right?
Now my mind is going crazy. I'm in the loop.
Especially since, like they're kind of describing Mars at the time. You know, it has some degree of forestation and reptiles survive on its surface. So why Ice Warriors? What's so icy about what's going on at the time?
So, final thoughts on this audio, guys. Did we enjoy it?
I'm in a time loop because of that.
Sorry, Jimmy.
Yeah.
Still thinking about it. Are we going to give Jimmy more time?
Time locked, Jimmy.
I know. It's like,
it's kind of like you know, I called them Daleks as an anagram of Khalid, which is sort of like, well, we're humans. That's why I called my creation the Muhan.
Yeah.
I have to wonder, did the original outline have the Doctor naming them as Ice Warriors? That seems like a more modern trope.
It does.
There's a lot of it. That was fun listening Waking to it, trying to figure out. Thing, yeah. I don't think that was in the original outline.
And there are so many parts of it. I mean, given that it's so easy to compare this in its structure and purpose to Genesis of the Daleks, you know, it's a pair of treatments that were written long before that story, yet they were adapted into this form long after that story. Yeah. So it's really, I'm very curious how much of the more modern take of how you tell an origin of one of the great monsters of Doctor Who found its way more into the adaptation than was in the original brief.
It's so interesting, all these different layers of time, when the original story was written, when it was adapted, the different expectations of what we want from a story, but the fact that it's deliberately modeling itself after a 1960s six-part television series with the rhythms and the cadences and the slow development of episode one.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot I enjoyed about this story just on its own merits, but the thing I guess my takeaway of what I found most interesting was just that window into the idea of, all right, we need a certain number of stories for this season. We want to bring the Ice Warriors back.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Give us some ideas for how to do that. Let's hear some Ice Warriors pitches. And there was one that got made, and this was one that didn't.
Yeah. Right.
And, you know, who knows, depending on if this version had been made, if that would have led to different Ice Warriors stories following that, or just a whole different path for the popularity of the Ice Warriors in the series.
Yeah. And they had those costumes. They had to try to use them. You're right.
It's true. I had to amortize the cost of those costumes over a season. Yeah, this one in particular, I got to say, I found it pretty dull. Mm-hmm. I'm glad I listened to it, but it's not something that I'm going to return to. It reminded me of how niche our enthusiasm can really get here.
Yes. This is for hardcore fans. This is not... Yes. If you kind of like the new series and you want to try Big Finish audio, you would not dip into this.
No, I wouldn't recommend it. There's very little here.
Not an audio I would recommend as one to start with.
No, and obviously you're applying a very different standard to boring versus exciting of something that you are listening to as an audio versus a TV episode. I mean, one of the reasons I love the Big Finish audio so much is I'm a big Doctor Who fan, and it's something I can have on in my studio while I'm working. Yep. It's something non-visual I can enjoy. But it also means you're watching perhaps a little more half-distracted than if you were watching it as a television show. Right. So you're applying a very different standard to it.
Right. And one of the stock criticisms people have about things that always drives me up a wall is, it was too long. But it was too long.
You know, it could use some editing, I think.
Yeah, I always found that the lamest criticism of.
No, but
I'm someone who likes the extended versions of the Lord of the Rings movies and the big goodbye at the end of Return of the King. I am totally on board with it, and I don't think that's at all draggy or anything.
But still, you found this too long.
But I still found this too long.
And now round 4, Special Topics Dalek Part 2. Chris, as our also guest, you you get a chance to give us a special topic.
There has been a lot of talk about people really liking the idea of the Doctor's granddaughter, Susan, making a reappearance somehow in the show. You know, Carol Ann Ford is still with us and has visited the set. Peter Capaldi has expressed a great desire to see her return. You know, I think it would be a lovely idea to have Susan back. I think most people have assumed that if you were going to do it, it would be to have Carol Ann Ford as Susan. But to me, it raises the question of, is having Carol Ann Ford as Susan the only way you could ever have Susan reappear? Could you have a regenerated Susan? And furthermore, do we know for certain that even if Susan is biologically the Doctor's granddaughter, that she's actually a Time Lord with the ability to regenerate?
Well, here's my initial thought. If we establish that Susan does not have the power to regenerate, then the only purpose to bring Carol Ann Ford back would be to have a tragic episode that would highlight the difference between the mortal Susan and the immortal grandfather.
Ah.
That sounds pretty depressing, frankly. So I would, you know, if I were writing the series, I would certainly bring Carol Ann Ford back to regenerate her. Because you're not going to expect her to be a continuing character for more than an episode or two on the show, but regenerate her into some a younger actress that could appear periodically from here on.
Or it could be a story about she doesn't have regenerations and we've seen that they can be gifted to
be the River Song of season 10.
I just suddenly had like the weird idea of like, okay, Susan could be, you know, the Doctor's granddaughter, but Susan's already on her 12th regeneration. For some reason, and
she had like, a very difficult childhood.
Yeah, and then like
there are reasons he took her away from Gallifrey.
Right,
bad things were happening to Susan and like
her,
Gallifrey.
Her like extreme youth and naivete is just kind of like a side effect of like this heavy regeneration very early in her life, so to speak.
So she went through a really clumsy adolescence and just ripped through all 12 regenerations.
Or you know, or it could be something super scary and tragic, and that was a reason why the Doctor left.
Well, know? I've mentioned this on the podcast before, but it's so great that I'm going to mention it again. Somewhere on the internet, I read the fan theory that the Master is actually Susan.
Wow!
At some point in the future, whoa, Susan regenerates into the Master, and that explains why the Doctor never kills that son of a bitch.
Wow! Well,
I know, I'm like,
that's super nutty.
And it seems odd that it has never come up.
Like, no one bothered to mention it?
Like, at no point does the Doctor say, I can't believe you've turned out this way, Susan.
Yeah. Well, this gives a great opportunity for an entire episode of clips from, you know, Terror of the Autons. Like, John Pertwee and...
Again, Susan. So we're basically talking about 40 years of deleted Susan references from Master Doctor
Just
encounters.
Like Clara was always there.
Excellent,
right?
Excellent.
Right.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, there was always... this is a little off topic, I suppose. Like the suggestion was always that the Doctor and the Master were like old school chums at one point or something. Or that they were like actually related, like brothers. I always kind of like the weird theory that the Master is the Doctor's son.
So Susan's dad.
It could be Susan's dad.
I was going to say, that was what I was going to say.
Yeah.
That would be a great storyline. Missy
and the Doctor originally left Gallifrey with Susan to get her away from her horrible father.
Abusive father.
Oh.
You guys, I think we've really dialed in on this.
I think this is it. This is why Susan's return is really a confrontation with her father, the Master.
I like it.
Wow. He's now her mother, and so maybe they can work out all these issues.
Right.
I'm not sure if this conversation means we should all be writing Doctor Who stories, or if it's an illustration of what I should only be drawing Doctor Who stories.
I think everyone needs to check out my fan fiction on my blog. Okay, folks, next up, it is time for the randomizer. And again, because we're at Council Room and we have a lot of Second Doctor era companions as guests, we are going to be talking about the moon base, which is the Second Doctor and features Jamie and Polly and Ben Jackson.
Correct.
And I understand it's also set on the moon.
In a base.
That was all correct. Someone tell him what he's won.
This lovely dinette set.
And it is the second appearance of the Cybermen?
Correct.
Yes.
Everyone is correct today.
Yes.
Yeah, I'm kind of surprised it's the second appearance of the Cybermen, and it's like about 100 years after the first appearance of the Cybermen, which is like supposed to be in the 1980s.
Yep.
But the perception of the Cybermen is that they were all destroyed and like almost like some weird legend or something.
My favorite thing about this story is all the sets. The moon base itself, the way the model matches up with the actual life-size set is rare in Doctor Who. Yeah.
As a base under siege story, production-wise, it's really impressive for the era of the show.
And those spacesuits. Guys, if we ever cosplay as a podcast, we're recreating those.
That would be
spaces. Real
easy cosplay to make.
And we are walking slow motion, low the moon gravity through the hallways.
Well, the goggles alone were my. I mean, the goggles were just like
we are Devo.
Yeah, it was. Oh,
I just love that the oxygen tank is just like a plastic water bottle.
Yeah, well.
Duct taped, I think.
Yeah. You know, as a broader thought about the Cybermen generally, as I was saying, my exposure to Doctor Who was starting watching for the beginning of the Tom Baker era, and I'd read about Doctor Who, so I'd heard of the Cybermen. But it's interesting to me how much they really are almost a fad of this 3-year stretch of the show, introduced in Hartnell's final story, popping up pretty regularly during the Troughton run, and then Pertwee never met them.
No, there's a cameo in Carnival of Monsters, and that's it.
First appearance in Tom Baker's first season, and then not again for the 7-year run of Tom Baker until Earthshock. It's kind of amazing to think that they went from that insanely popular, rivaling the Daleks, to really hardly showing up for over a decade.
Even though they were still very much in the consciousness of Doctor Who fans, I think.
Yeah, they're always in the comics and in the annuals and things.
And having known, more of the later, especially the Peter Davison and beyond era Cybermen, which I love the visual design. I do love the voices of the Troughton era Cybermen. They're very flat. The mouth slit that just opens during the duration of them speaking and then closes again. Yes. It makes them feel really chillingly inhuman.
Yeah, it's like this existential scream every time they talk. Their mouth just opens.
But in the same way that I think part of the effectiveness of the Daleks is that they so successfully feel not human. I think those qualities really help the Cybermen achieve that as well. Peter Davison and beyond era Cybermen really feel much more emotional, like they're throwing tantrums and really have lost that computer on legs kind of quality that the early Cybermen had.
Well, you're right, because it goes back to the idea that he says, you're doing this, so you're just doing this for revenge, and they're like, no, you're just a threat, we're killing you. And it wasn't like, there isn't this emotion, we don't have those emotions.
They have the one line where they say, only stupid human brains have been fooled. Yes. So yes. They still have a little bit. There's a little pettiness somewhere buried in
but they
their
do
cybernetics.
Have, I agree, I much prefer these early Cybermen. Yeah. This is written by Kit Pedler, who created them, and so it's closest to the original idea of what the Cybermen were going to be like. This probably has my favorite Cybermen line ever, where one of the moonbase guys asks them, have you no mercy? And the Cyberman says, it is unnecessary.
Yes.
That unnecessary does so much work there to tell you what the Cybermen are about.
Well, we also see, too, and it was funny because Annika mentioned this today in her panel, Annika Wills, that this was the point where it was like, what do we do with Ben and what do we do with Jamie?
Oh,
because
yeah.
we really have two people who are mirroring the same. So it was like, well, let's just put Jamie under, basically, for most of this episode. And this is early, obviously, in his tenure.
Yeah.
But it was interesting to hear her say that today, because I was like, oh, it makes complete sense. Because rewatching it, I was like, what's going on?
And then when Jamie does wake up, he argues with Ben,
yeah,
too.
They're
literally... Right. They make a narrative point of that they're both trying to do the same function.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, this was originally written before they...
That's what she's,
before
yes.
Fraser Hines got hired.
And the Second Doctor and Jamie don't have any of the chemistry that we associate with the two of them. In general, the Second Doctor is early on. This is one of the most somber performances from Patrick Troughton I've seen. There's not a lot of goofiness. He's very
when he unties
serious.
That one worker's shoe.
You're right.
It's also interesting because... We see such a contrast in the way Polly is treated. That's another moment we were talking about.
Yeah.
Like, drove me crazy. It's like all of a sudden she's like, she comes up, she thinks of the idea of how to basically destroy the Cybermen.
Yeah.
But at the same point, she's got to get coffee, everybody. She has to. Let's have her bring
but
in
the
coffee.
Fact that she brings coffee helps them figure
yes,
out.
Yes, it is true. unintentional. But it was like, it was just funny because you watch a moment where she comes up with the idea. Yeah. Like, she is the one that thinks of it.
Well, she comes up with the idea and it's all cool, but it is also kind of through this weird girly way where she, like, knows what the chemistry of nail polish.
Yeah, that's what I mean. I was gonna say,
The fact that their weakness is nail polish remover. Too. They have that in common with, like, drag queens. That's also their weakness.
No, I think it is.
People complain about gold.
Well in an early draft of the story, actually featured drag queens attacking a moon base, and someone said, well, let's bring back the Cybermen instead.
But yeah, it is interesting.
Tomb of the drag queens.
Sorry. All right, now Priscilla, queen of time.
I'm ready for that. Maybe the Ronnie returns with the whole, like, army of drag queens behind her.
But you're right, this story really is Exhibit A regarding sexism in Doctor Who. You see the clip of Polly bringing coffee in all of the various retrospectives that are like, oh, look how sexist it was in the 60s. And and this one is pretty, not you, Polly, this is men's work. Now, that's Ben, because Ben is always like that.
Yeah, well,
but I think that, I honestly think that's a character moment for Ben, because the next scene, she's there with the spray gun shooting nail polish remover onto the Cybermen and killing them with those guns.
I meant to mention this in our Lords of the Red Planet discussion, but I forgot about it. The funny self-aware line of Zoe's going to help the doctor make the life drink, and Jamie's, oh, well, what can I do? You hand us test tubes and stand there and look pretty.
Right. No, I did love that.
Pour some more leg.
I also did love that the moon base is international.
Yes.
Yeah.
Granted, I think I have a note in here that says international dialects, ha-ha, in my notes.
The obligatory, embarrassing Frenchman.
Yes, the Frenchman was just, as somebody says.
The Frenchman who has the...
Yes,
scarf tied around the neck.
Signifying scarf. Yeah.
And then there was...
I am French. Look at my scarf.
I am wearing an identifying scarf as according to the regulations.
We were going
to
have a Lumiere moment from Beauty and the Beast.
And then there was the character Nils, who is either Swedish or Danish, but it's hard to tell because the Swedish and Danish flag look exactly alike in black and white.
Right, right.
I love the line, though, once they get into the moon base, and I can't remember which scientist says it. He's like, oh, one of them is in the med bay right now, and he says, he's all right. He just knocked himself out or something. It's like, I don't know.
Whacking himself in the head with a wrench like you do.
He should just
too many male companions.
Well, I also like that it was never really addressed. That is it really a good thing that this base is controlling the weather on all the Earth? Like, that's never really addressed.
And the technology is a mix of far advanced technology with that there literally has to be a guy manually controlling it.
I loved that. That's so 1960s.
It's
written by Kit Pedler, who kind of knows his stuff. He's a genuine scientist, and so he's the technical elements of it are kind of pure. We can't depress it more than 30 degrees unless we take off
They're removing the safety bolt.
It's so material. It's so physical. I really like that.
Everybody's just like, hey, you know what? We're just going to get this base. And by the way, let's control the weather,
I have to assume it's a virtue out of necessity. Like, that's they can't what I control too, it from that, Earth.
No, I completely was like, there has to be a reason scientifically, or the planet is in a situation where this...
Well, but I always love in science fiction stories where they don't necessarily walk you through every bit of logic, but it feels like there is some sort of structural logic behind it all.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, as dated as a lot of this seems, this is... I love the moon base. I think it's terrific. It's a very solid story. It's one of the very early base under siege ones. Yeah. Is maybe the 10th planet the only other one?
I think
they're both Cybermen ones. Yeah. And so very early on.
The music in this one.
Yeah. I love the Cybermen theme.
Oh, it's so cool. And just the weird ambient, it's more sound effects, like when they first get out of the TARDIS on the moon. And then like the proto $6 million man sound when they leap into the air every time. It's awesome.
You know, every time they're in the moon base, there's this in the background that it kept making me think, is my phone ringing? And I'm looking at the table.
The idea of chemical warfare. I mean, you watch how they basically contaminate food to get their group of minions because they know they can't go in to the Gravitron area. But it was like, this is dark and it's disturbing. I mean,
it is kind of interesting. You mentioning the idea that the only real previous base under siege story we can think of is the previous Cybermen story, the 10th Planet. The various parallels between these two stories. The idea of going from the remote Arctic location of the 10th planet and then switching to this lunar base, as far as, you know, we want an inhospitable exterior environment that the Cybermen can easily move through where our characters can't. You know, it's just sort of interesting looking at this as a clever remake of the 10th planet in some
really
ways.
Is.
Not to knock it as being derivative of the earlier
it's
work,
better.
But just as far as that idea of how to do a Cyberman story when there's only been one example previously.
Yep. Well, it is interesting because tying it into how we've seen the Cybermen progress now over time, because to me what was interesting about the whole idea of contaminating the sugar and kind of this transition of what they were turning these people into, we see this progression of how this assimilation, so to speak, changes over time. And I don't know, it was interesting to see.
Yeah, because we see them turn humans into proto-Cybermen here. That's the first time we see it. We don't see it in the 10th planet.
And then it progresses and progresses and progresses over time that we see how that evolves to even more of...
Yeah, it's so disturbing they didn't really do it much in the original series. They do it in Attack of the Cybermen to quite horrific effect, but they only really play with it in the new series.
Right.
Oh, yeah, when the cyber-controlled guy sends the rescue ship into the sun.
Yes.
That's horrifying.
That is horrifying.
And it's like, and he says, it could take a week as they slowly die to the sun. It's like,
there's nothing anyone can do about it, period.
Yeah, it's like early enough in
that's like in a 2001.
Space, like space exploration that you can't just, rescue mission. Got him, you know.
But it is good to know that a bath mat will protect you from the rat.
No.
Why is that? Why is a bath... I kept going, is that a bath mat? Is it...
It's sort of ominous, but it's kind of funny that shot where they realize the control guy's sending it to the sun and he turns around.
That's creepy.
Like,
it's creepy.
I'm wearing the hat.
I've
set the controls for the heart of the sun. I'm Sid Barrett. Pink Floyd has taken over the moon base.
Another thought about this being the second appearance of the Cybermen compared to the 10th planet is just the evolution of the Cybermen's look. They obviously threw a little more money at the costumes this time. There is something I actually always liked about the human hands on the originals. As silly as like the cloth face masks looked, there is something a little more Frankensteinian about
the hand.
The combination of human parts on an otherwise mechanical body. But overall, boy, is this a leap forward into the Cybermen taking on a very striking and iconic look as compared to what we saw of them.
Yeah, their later Second Doctor appearances, though, start to look a little shabby.
Yeah.
Because they're reusing the same costumes and kind of fiddling with them and putting mascara on them and things.
According to Annika Wells today, the costume designer put all this effort into doing the original costume. She's like, oh my God, I didn't do the hands. So that's why they painted them initially.
Well, and Calvin, something you talked about the last time we recorded. This is one of the first times that there's a mission statement of what we think of as Doctor Who.
I've seen the moon base brought up notably by Charlie Jane Anders. This is kind of a watershed moment in Doctor Who where the Doctor kind of transitions from being this guy who just sort of stumbles onto stuff to like a more active participant in a fight against evil.
And he has a speech too to the moon base commander.
Yeah.
There are corners of the universe that have bred the most horrible things.
Yeah.
And they must be fought.
The Second Doctor being kind of simultaneously one of the most kindly doctors and like the most neoconservative foreign policy.
Exactly. He's like, axis of evil, we're going after it.
Yeah. Again, it's one of the first base under siege kind of stories, and it's like really kind of a very transitionary story between sort of what the first Doctor era was like, and then like what Doctor Who kind of becomes, like what we think of as Doctor Who.
Yeah.
So we hated it, right?
Yeah.
Well, that's our show. We'd like to thank Console Room 2016, and of course our guests, Christopher Jones and Jimmy LeDuc. I'm Pat.
I'm Joshua.
And I'm Kelvin.
And until next time, we're saying,
get off my world!
I haven't done any butt jokes yet this episode.
We can always edit an old one in and have a surplus.